Together. We were of a generation that got married very young, and we also benefited from the advances in medical sciences. So we had 53 golden years together, my Soli and I. I've never known another man as perfect as my Soli. Handsome, clever, hardworking, kind, strong, I could go on forever. Always protective, generous and loving, and a wonderful sense of humor, able to make me laugh away bitterness, sadness or anger. It seems almost impossible that he's left me alone now. I cannot even remember a time when he was not there to look after me. Was I ever a single girl? After babies, grandchildren and great-grandchildren, who can remember back to one's own childhood? But I can still remember the first time I saw my Soli. Actually, I saw only his shoes. I was too shy to raise my head. And my Soli's shoes were beautiful, black and polished to a mirror finish. I'd never seen anything so fancy in our village. My mother put red dots on his forehead and on the fronts of his shoes in our customary gesture of welcome. It was only later that I discovered that polishing his shoes was part of his daily ritual and that he'd hated those red dots on them, ruining their impeccable sheen. Another of his daily rituals was our morning walk. As the first rosy fingers of dawn crept over the edge of the world, we'd step out together. After we returned, we sat together on the balcony and shared our tea and biscuits. And I was not to be asked to do any housework until he gave me leave to rise from his side. My demurs and his mother's scoldings that it was hardly appropriate that she should serve me were just brushed aside. It was terribly unnerving for me, young as I was. But my mother-in-law was a kindly person whom I grew to love very much. And she well knew on whose shoulders the responsibility lay. I soon learned that my Soli was a law unto himself. All of us gave him his way because we loved him, but also because he never gave us any other option. I came to relish these morning walks. They were a mentally calm but physically brisk start to the day. A time for us to be alone together. To talk if we wanted to stay silent if we chose to. Soli wore track pants and a t-shirt with a collar. I always preferred my saris. I've never worn anything else my whole life, so though friends tell me other clothes are more convenient, my saris are convenient enough for me. But I do wear socks and shoes. And what fancy shoes we now wear compared to what Sola first bought me when we were newly married. Those were plain white and thin-soled. He taught me to put blanco on them every day so that they'd look fresh for the next morning and wash them every few days, and in the rainy season, stuff crumpled newspapers in them to help them dry out. Soli loved to tell how I'd torn my first pair in just 2 months and been too ashamed to admit it. He caught me hobbling and discovered it himself. According to his story, I was in tears that he'd have to spend more money to buy me a new pair. I'd thought shoes should last forever, years at least. I'd wanted to put wads of newspaper inside and carry on. After all, the tops were still like new. I'd never had shoes like these before, or gone for morning walks or done any of these city things. How was I to know that wearing out like this was normal and that Sola could afford to replace them as often as they tore? I was very young and innocent and had only known life in my small village. Nowadays children know everything. When our children were born, we could still teach them, thank God. But grandchildren and great-grandchildren have to teach us nowadays. That computer was so hard to learn. I used to make notes and write everything down in a book and practice secretly. And in a few years, just when I was feeling confident, one of these young ones would come and charge up solely. Grandpa, get rid of this old thing. They meant the computer, of course. But I teased them that one day they'd get rid of the two of us too, since we were of much older vintage than that silly computer. Soli would always be ready to get a new piece, with more features for us to learn, and faster, so the young ones said. What we needed faster for, I cannot say, since we had all day free at our age. But if I grumbled that there was nothing wrong with the old one, the rascals would say, Grandma, don't you always say, be generous and give things away while they still have life in them, so others can enjoy them? So then, I'd have to agree. Mobile phone was easier. My sweet Rush taught me very lovingly how to use the calendar and the camera and everything. In our days, a photograph used to be a big thing. We wore our best clothes and posed with a painted scene behind us. There'd be an armchair and a marble table with leather-bound books and a vase full of flowers and a dark velvet curtain draped artistically at the side. And after all that, we got a small photo in black and white, pasted on a thick, creamy board to make it look impressive. Then Soli bought our first camera. It had a brown leather case and a tripod stand, and you had to hide under a black cloth to take photos. And the children would be fidgety or crying. It was all so difficult. Now it's part of my phone, and I get instant photos. Something called digital that I don't understand, but in color and so lifelike. Wonderful things have happened in our time. I learned all these things with my Sola at my side, encouraging me lovingly. So after 53 years together, it's very difficult for me to be alone. But he'd not want me to be sad. He'd want everything to be as usual. So I must honor him by doing that. Which is why I was lacing up my shoes firmly in the still dark of the early morning. It would be light soon, and I would set off for my first morning walk alone. I was worried about the stray dogs. When we walked together, I was never afraid. Soli always kept me on the inside of the pavement and looked so confident and ramrod straight. No dog would ever think of challenging him. But on my own, I have to admit, I was a bit nervous. Pretending a confidence I didn't have, I started out determinedly. But as I approached the main road, I could hear them on the prowl. And only loyalty to my Sola made me soldier on. Suddenly, out of nowhere, I realized I had a companion. Walking on the outside, between me and the road, was a black and white dog. He looked up at me and wagged his curly tail. Friendly fellow. But I'd never seen him before. No collar, so he must be a stray. But he looked so poised and aristocratic. Not at all like a rowdy stray. He kept pace with me, slowing down at the crossings and trotting along down the streets. And thankfully, the pack of strays kept away from us. It was strangely comforting to have him along. It bolstered my confidence and made me smile. Dad had to find out if he belonged to anyone, because he really was a handsome dog with such a dignified bearing. I'd give him some milk and bread when we got home, I decided. Just one more crossing and a few steps to our gate. But as we crossed the road, the dog stopped. I called him and he wagged his tail, but he refused to budge. He planted his white paws firmly and lowered himself onto the pavement. He crossed his front legs elegantly like a gentleman, looked up sincerely into my face and wagged his tail at me.
I felt myself go cold and hot and cold again. I couldn't see properly because my eyes were filled with tears. I wiped them away with the edge of my sari, pretending I was mopping sweat, and looked again. I wasn't imagining. On those white paws, right there, on the tips in front, quite unmistakably, were two bright red dots.
The lace dress. Auntie Hilda was a high-end couturier and also conducted dressmaking courses. The course girls hardly ever saw the wealthy couture customers. The tailors for the customers' clothes had been with Auntie Hilda forever, as had Auntie Minnie, whom she called her friend, but who was a kind of companion, really. I'd learned dressmaking here, worked with Auntie as her assistant, then chief assistant, and for the last few years, as partner. Every year, for as far back as I can remember, she'd have a bout of depression, I suppose one should call it. As a certain date approached, she'd become nostalgic and weepy. She'd bring out a grainy old black and white photograph in a silver frame. A young man in a dark coloured suit, slender, tall and handsome, and herself at his side, looking impossibly curvy and young. They were affianced and soon to be married. But he died, and she never let another man enter the bastion of her faithful heart. She grieved for him every year. After the photograph had been wept over, the lace would come out. A heavy ivory gipio lace. It was exquisite. It was beyond exquisite, the most gorgeous lace in the world. It was thickly encrusted with flowers, pointy-petaled flowers and round-petaled flowers, intertwined with leaves and indescribable curlicues. They were at multiple levels, so there was a continuous tracery that formed the body of the fabric, and then there were overlayers of petals that could flutter and move. Some of these were edged in silver thread, so the whole fabric glinted in the light. She'd bought it for her own wedding gown, and it had tragically not been needed. Once a year, it was released from its muslin cocoon and aired out. After a few days, we'd roll it all up again, and she'd pack it away safely. Slowly, she'd dial back the despondent mood, and in a week, she'd be back to normal. This, with the lace, was an annual ritual, and all of us old-timers knew it well. This year, I noticed her mood changing earlier than usual. She withdrew from the classes and attended on very few customers. Strictly no brides. I covered for her, as always. The photo came out, then the lace. And then she made a heart-stopping announcement. She wanted to cut and stitch it to make a long dress for herself.
cut it? That lace, which we'd almost worshipped these many years? It was inconceivable. Auntie Minnie was in tears. The tailors were dumbstruck. I actually shuddered. But she was certain. Its time had come. Under the umbrella of Auntie Hilda's certainty, I brought out the thin paper for the pattern. We knew we had to extend the back shoulders and raise the back neck to cover the hump in her back. We had to shorten the front shoulders similarly. Her left hip had to be an inch wider than her right, and the dress had to be an inch longer on that side to make the hemline look straight. We had to put darts in the front of her ramsays so they wouldn't reveal what she primly called her unmentionables. The pattern was simple, fitted across her still robust bosom and floating gracefully down to her ankles so that the beautiful fabric got full play. Scattered pearls to dot the lace, that's it. So the paper pattern was a breeze. I drew the lines authoritatively in red and blue pencil. The paper scissors cruised through the crackly paper. Auntie sat in her raised chair and supervised every step, her eyes focused on the cutting table. She asked me to lay out the heavy, cream-coloured satin that would be the lining of the dress. I marked it with marking papers and a dressmaker's wheel. On her nod, I brought the heavy fabric scissors with their gold-coloured handles and cut through the satin fabric without a moment's hesitation. Then, Auntie Hilda asked me to lay out the lace. I was exhilarated, filled with light myself on the inside, to be folding, caressing and smoothing this ethereal fabric. I pinned the paper pattern in place with colourful pearl-headed pins, and they stood out like gemstones against the old magnolia-coloured lace. I double-checked everything. The pattern on the front and back lined up perfectly at the side seams. It would appear almost seamless. Time to make the first cut. And then the panic struck. Suppose I'd made a mistake? This material was not replaceable, not for love of money. I turned to Auntie with frightened eyes. Let's cut a sample dress first, Auntie. She looked at me in a most un-Auntie Hilda-like, sweet, serene way and said, "No, my child, it's perfect. You haven't put a step wrong. It's just a dress. Go on, cut it." But I was completely overcome by nerves. That fabric had too heavy a history for me. My hands were trembling. I dared not put scissors to fabric in that condition. I pressed my hands to the cutting table. I washed them with warm water. I walked around to relax. The trembling stopped, and I returned to the cutting table and reached for the scissors, and I was quivering uncontrollably again. Finally, Auntie got off her chair and picked up the heavy scissors herself. I was relieved, but also nervous. She hadn't cut anything in years. I'd taken over all of that. But her fingers slipped into those scissors as if they were going home. She looked younger, straighter, and a warm glow surrounded her. The scissors went chick, chick, chick through the fabric with confident authority. I moved in to roll up the fabric into lots. Front, back, top, skirt panels. The tailors were summoned and given their instructions. They looked as nervous as I'd felt. But she was cool and certain, and she oozed confidence into us. The work started. They outlined and pinned and tacked, And as Auntie Hilda watched over them, the dress slowly and successfully came together. She tried it on and we checked everything meticulously. The zip and the back seam were already machine stitched. Everything else was only hand tacked as yet. It fell smoothly in soft folds to her fragile ankles, skimmed her hips gracefully. The hemline was straight as an arrow. The neckline sat snug on her aged chest, never shifting or gaping. The arm's eyes hugged her crepey old arms decorously, and no unmentionables peeped through. Auntie Minnie cautioned her, "But it's not going to fit you when it's ready if you keep starving yourself." That was the first I'd heard of it, but instantly I knew it was true. Auntie Hilda swatted her friend playfully and told her to be off with her. She was just fine. She produced 4 boxes of pearls that even I'd never seen before in all these years. There were round ones in 3 different sizes and 1 box of teardrop-shaped ones. The dress was taken apart again and the sides, top and bottom were carefully overlocked so that no loose threads would cause the lace to unravel. Then the tailors were given detailed instructions for the handwork. Which pearl should be stitched into the center of which flower? The round ones were to be stitched in, and the tiny teardrop ones were to be left dangling enticingly. They were all stitched in silver thread, so it would add to the subdued radiance of the dress. The tailors were allowed to start work on the dress only when Auntie Hilda was in place beside them. They'd lay out a fresh, clean base fabric, bring out the bundles and parcels of the lace dress, and commence work under her watchful eye. She refused to eat or drink or talk during these sessions. We learned to leave her alone with the tailors and her dress. More and more frequently, I'd hear Auntie Minnie berating her about not eating. This was most unlike Auntie Hilda. She normally went to her meals with gusto. Usually I didn't get into this side of things. But when the scolding from the dining room became too much, I finally weighed in. I told her we'd have to make 100 alterations to her lovely lace dress if she lost any more weight. That had its intended effect, and she resumed eating, Auntie Minnie confirmed. With nothing like her usual eagerness, but she did eat. So the bickering was reduced and harmony reigned between them again. In the meantime, all the pearls were finally fixed with the exact level of tension as approved by Auntie Hilda, and the garment was put together again. It hung on a padded and silk beribboned hanger. That incomparable lace, the gleaming satin underlayer, the gentle glow of the pearls, the subtle shimmer of the silver flower tips and the thread stitching, the flutter of the 3D petals, and the timorous sway of the teardrop pearls. How can I describe to you how beautiful it was? It made my heart tighten in my chest and ache just to look at it. The tailors brought out a long muslin sleeve to cover it as usual. But she asked that it be hung just like that, open, in her room. She thanked them and me very formally and said we'd done an excellent job for her and she was proud of us. We were embarrassed, but she insisted that we deserved the praise. Now that it was ready, I felt she looked a bit wilted and tired. It had taken the stuffing out of her, getting it perfect. She could rest now, I thought. That evening, she asked me to stay back. She went into her room with Auntie Minnie and came out a while later wearing the lace dress and a pair of satin slippers. Her thin, papery skin wrinkled and crepey, her soft, cushiony contours, her pale features, bright eyes and sweet, sad smile were the perfect backdrop. Auntie Minnie and I cheered and smiled through our tears. I made her do a small walkabout, a few slow turns, and recorded it all on video. She was shining and radiant and so happy in that dress. This dear old lady in a bridal gown and no groom on the horizon. She sent me off home with a small pat on my cheek and then changed back into her everyday clothes. Auntie Minnie and she had a simple dinner together and then turned in for the night as usual. That was yesterday. As we know now, later that night, in the quiet privacy of her bedroom, she somehow put on her bridal gown and satin slippers again, lay down in her bed, and drifted off quietly and efficiently to rejoin her beloved fiancé, awaiting her on the other side. Auntie Minnie found her this morning lying serenely in her bed in that utterly splendid dress with a gentle smile on her lips. That lace dress took more than half a century to fulfill its destiny, but it got there in the end.
My kind of girl. I felt like a complete ass. I looked at the pretty girl in her favorite nook of the compartment. She wasn't just pretty, actually, but compelling in some inexplicable way. She had kind of glow, a radiance, that I don't know how to describe without sounding corny. She usually sat there with her nose in a book. She always seemed disconnected from the goings-on around her on the train. I was drawn to her powerfully. I wanted to talk to her, to know her better. But she hadn't responded to any of my admittedly subtle moves. I'd been brought up to believe that there's only so much a man can push within the bounds of decency and politeness. A strong mother, three aunts and an elder sister made sure I learned that lesson well. I first saw her about 3 weeks before this momentous day. When I got on at my regular stop for the journey home, she was already in what was to become her favorite seat. I wasn't the only one who stared, for she was so disengaged with her surroundings that she attracted notice. Occasionally, she took a brief look around the compartment, but mostly she was submerged in her book, never acknowledging any of the activities on the train. Her books must have been utterly fascinating, I thought. She never received or made any phone calls or text messages, unlike almost everybody else on the train. She never made eye contact with anyone, certainly not with me. Sometimes she checked her watch or the station we were entering, and she got off at the stop before mine and disappeared from view in the throng on the platform. The first thing I'd noticed about her was her hair, tied in a glossy black plait, fastened with a plain elastic band
and ending in an impossibly silken skein. She wore the plait over her right shoulder, and even draped like that, it reached down past her waist and nestled in her lap. Her hands were delicate, with long, slender fingers and a pale, shiny nail polish. Her eyes were always cast down at her book, so I saw only the lowered lids and the velvety curtain of lashes. There was just a hint of color on her almost translucent cheeks. It looked natural, not out of a box, or whatever girls took color out of to put on their cheeks. She was tiny, and if she didn't get her seat, I would get on the train to see her standing beside a vertical bar because there was no way she could reach the overhead rail. She even read standing up, with her arms wrapped around that bar and her eyes glued to her book. She intrigued me. She fascinated me. She mesmerized me. And tragically, she never even noticed me. I tried to get a seat or to stand beside her. I tried saying hello and introducing myself. She didn't even lift her head to acknowledge my presence. It was cutting. In the face of this complete non-recognition of my existence, I opted to withdraw, since my even so hesitant attentions were apparently unwelcome. But a cat may look at a queen, as the adage goes, and nothing could stop me from looking. All this admiring from afar had been continuing every workday evening. In the spirit of complete honesty, I'll confess, I even briefly considered getting off at her stop and following from afar. She had me so wound up. But discussions in my female-dominated home about filthy stalkers rang in my ears, and I knew such a step was completely beyond the pale. But I was tempted, I won't deny it. And then this particular day, the same routine. Got on the train, looked for her, felt a tug inside my chest at sight of her, and was completely and totally ignored by her. A chap about our age moved up to her and waved his hand behind her book where it would certainly disturb her reading. She looked up questioningly and broke into a hesitant smile. Instantly, they were chatting. And that's why I started by calling myself an ass. Because they were chatting with their hands. Sign language. She was evidently hearing impaired. Now everything made sense. The not engaging on the train, the indistractability, the lack of response to my hesitant hellos. I can admit it now, though I didn't want to belabor it earlier, because I thought it was rude. And I didn't want you to think of her as rude. She didn't look rude. She looked gentle and charming and intelligent. In other words, my kind of girl. So I watched the two of them, chatting away cheerfully. I thought she wasn't as into it as he was, but you'll just say I was jealous. To be totally honest, I was. It was an unfair advantage for him to know sign language and be able to communicate with her, and for me to be left out in the cold, unable to speak to her or to be heard by her. I felt it deeply, and I recognized the irony of it. My jealous fit was mercifully short as she got up to disembark at her usual stop. They waved to each other, and instantly she joined the crowd on the platform and was gone. My stop was next, and the intruder stayed on the train, so I have no idea where he went on to, and I hoped that that would be the last I'd see of him, which is exactly as it turned out to be. I was still mulling over the unfairness of it when I came up with a genuine big daddy of an idea. This was earth-shattering, life-changing. It's going to sound simple when I say it, but it's like magic. Once it's explained, it seems easy. To me, it was like a thunderbolt. Here it comes. I didn't need to be deaf to learn sign language. Like I didn't need to be French or Russian to learn those languages. Sign language was just another foreign language, and I could be me and still learn it. No need to feel handicapped because I wasn't hearing impaired. I almost missed my stop as my body sang with the sheer excitement of it. In fact, I would have if an old lady hadn't prodded me with her umbrella and asked me if I wasn't getting off here today. I flung her a quick thanks and just squeezed through the doors in time. It's not called the Internet of All Things for nothing. With a few taps, I found dozens of short YouTube videos teaching me how to sign hello and goodbye and my name, please, thank you, how are you, and random other bits of conversation. And I practiced diligently in front of the mirror until I was signing them confidently. To say I was excited is so much of an understatement. It's not even in the same country, let alone the ballpark. I was crazy with delight. She was my dream girl. Everything about her felt perfect. The stillness of her, her hands, her face, her raven hair, the subtle glow that emanated from her, the tingling I felt when I got on that train and knew she was on it too. I'd been wringing myself out, feeling rejected and not knowing why, and now I had a shot. So the next day, I made bold to move over in her direction and stand in front of her as I'd seen the other fellow do the previous evening. I waved my hand behind her book as he had, and when she looked up, I signed a hello. Words fail me. And perhaps that's good, because you'll just have a snarky laugh and say I'm besotted. But the light in her eyes as she responded to my hello, I can't even begin to describe it. Her hands flew in a fury of chatter, but my eyes were still stuck on her radiant face. In none of my bedroom preparations the night before had I learned how to sign. I'm only just learning, so don't go into a fast chat because I won't be able to keep up. But what's meant to be is meant to be. And I had another stroke of genius and pulled out my phone and typed that out instead. And she grabbed my phone and replied. And I told her how I hadn't realized she was hearing impaired till the day before, and that I'd taught myself a bit overnight so I could say hello. In case anyone wants to know, that's absolutely the perfect hook for any girl, that you did something over the top just for her. Her eyes went big and dark and round with softness, and I was drowning in deliciousness. Her stop came and she got off. I scrambled home and taught myself a little more each night. Plus, I had my personal private tutor too, on the homebound train every workday evening. Things moved fast and we started meeting off the train too in a stunningly bold and audacious move. Dame Fortune smiled on this audacity and rewarded me handsomely for it. Not to make an itemized list of the proceedings, the years passed and the river of life led us to many strange places. But the brightest light in my life is still from the same true source. My first impression of her was 100% correct. She was and will always be my kind of girl.